This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. One of the staples of our culture, aside from cheeseburgers and reality TV, is the ubiquitous opinion poll. Hardly a day goes by that you don't see a poll about next year's presidential election, the war in Iraq, or whether some Wall Street tycoon should go to jail. But how accurate are these polls? Do they really reflect what you are thinking? Some polls are run by political parties who have a stake in the outcome, and the results can reflect that bias. How does that happen if polling is supposed to be based on sound scientific principles? We're broadcasting today from the Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul, and we'll talk about the science of polling. We'll also talk about how technology is changing the way your opinion is registered. Is it making democracy work better? Plus, how politicians use polls. Consider this recent ABC News Washington Post poll of 1,200 adults nationwide. Majority of those surveyed, 54%, said they thought the war with Iraq was worth fighting. But when asked if they supported or opposed the $87 billion the president requested for the war and rebuilding efforts, nearly two-thirds said they opposed the spending plan. Yet Congress approved the spending, seemingly at odds with public opinion. Is it typical that politicians ignore the results of polls like these? Then why take them? We'll talk with a political scientist about how the administration might use a poll to win support for its policy decisions. Our program is part of the Whose Democracy Is It Project, which is a consortium of public radio stations talking about that topic all this week. And if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the audience here in St. Paul, you can step up to the microphones right there on the floor and ask your question. And of course, if you want more information, you can always surf over to our website at Science Friday, where you'll find links to our topic. Let me introduce my guest. Rob Daves is the Director of Strategic and News Research and the Director of the Minnesota Poll at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ara.
You're welcome. Lawrence Jacobs is the co-author of Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and Loss of Democratic Responsiveness, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2000. He's the Land-Grant McKnight Professor at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and the director of the 2004 Election Project at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute there. Welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Ara.
Thank you. Alan Yelsey is the president of Interactive Meetings in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ara.
Rob, let's start off by talking about how a poll is done. What do you do once you decide you want to conduct a poll? Lay it out for us.
Well, several things happen simultaneously. First of all, I get together, I work for the newspaper, obviously, so I get together with reporters and editors, and we decide exactly what direction the poll wants to take. We have to construct measures that will take accurate, unbiased, reliable, valid measures of what it is we want to look at. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a questionnaire. We write a questionnaire. At the same time, one of my staff members draws the sample of telephone numbers, the ones that we will be calling to administer this questionnaire. So a couple or three things are happening at that time.
Larry, how important is the wording of the questions?
Well, that matters a lot. I mean, obviously, the example you just gave on the war in Iraq is a perfect example. Americans believe that the war was worth it, it was the right decision, and they support it. Though those numbers are down, it's still a majority. On the other hand, whether it's $87 billion or it's the casualties, they've got concerns. So if you wanted to know about public opinion on Iraq, you would have to ask several questions. If you went with just one of those questions, you would not be getting the full picture.
Mm-hmm. So the questions are how they're phrased and which questions you choose, could that skew the outcome of the poll?
It can. And you know, Rob will tell you this, and those of us who do a lot of survey research will tell you we put a lot of time into coming up with the question, and often we'll pretest it. We'll actually go out and ask the question and then ask it in different ways and look mm-hmm. at the impact of particular words. So, for instance, during the debate over welfare reform, it really mattered if you used the word welfare or helping the poor. People really didn't like welfare, but helping the poor, there's still very strong support for that.
Mm-hmm. Larry's absolutely right. We've experienced the same kind of thing, and in fact, during our tests, it's a little term of art that pollsters use called pretest. What we do is write a questionnaire and then actually administer the questionnaire to people just like the folks in our studio audience here. We go back and interview the interviewers and say, mm-hmm. was it hard to understand? What words were hot buttons? Mm-hmm. will this question work better than another type of question, an open-end question or a closed-end question?
So you got your questions, you got your sample. Now, how do you choose whom you're going to ask? How do you pick that sample of people you're going to ask?
Well, that's where we start with our sampling. We take a random sample of all of the households with telephones in the state of Minnesota, in the city of Minneapolis, or for national polling, which we occasionally do in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And so that small number can be accurate to represent a larger number?
Oh, absolutely. Everybody's familiar with Star Trek, right? And so everybody remembers Mr. Spock explaining to the stupid Jim Kirk, captain of the Enterprise, that in a positive gravity, if you drop a hammer, the hammer will drop straight down. Okay, well, everybody knows that. Well, that's the way the laws of statistics work. If you draw a random sample, it will be representative of the population.
And how many people do you need to ask the questions?
It depends on how precise you want to be. If you want to be very precise, you draw a fairly large sample, 2,500. Most of us typically live in the world of sample sizes around 1,000.
Mm-hmm. And do you then include, if you're doing a random sample, how do you know you're going to get people from, let's say, every part of the state?
Oh, that's the beautiful part of random sampling. It always works out.
Magic, in other words.
Yes.
I see, okay.
Yeah, it's not magic. It's science. Mm-hmm. You know, Science Friday, it's science. This is the way it works.
Mm-hmm. And do you ever oversample where you want to get more people, and why would you do that?
Oh, of course we do. One of the reasons we oversample is to make sure that we have enough people of a certain type. For example, if in a particular state you wanted to make sure that you had enough independent voters and not just Democrats or Republicans, you might need to oversample them and then analyze them individually. But you've got to control for that. And the way you do it is through a process called, and here's the statistics, weighting, in which...
Wait, with a D or a T? Weighting into them or weighting for them?
Well, you wade into the dating, but you weight, W-E-I-G-H-T, to make sure that you bring those independent voters back into the correct proportions that they would be in the regular population.
All right, now you've told us that this is a science, and you've made it clear to us, and I'll ask both of you, then how come we get polls from political parties, Republicans, Democrats, which is supposedly, I would imagine they are scientists as well as pollsters. They come up with the answers skewed to what they, I'm afraid to say, what they want to hear from their political party.
Well, the key part of your question is what we hear from the parties. The parties are not giving us their entire survey. They're selectively releasing some of the results that are going to help them, and they're not showing you results that may not look so good for them.
Why do we let them get away with this?
Well, the truth is we shouldn't. And the main rule of consuming polls is you always want to know who sponsored and paid for it and who's conducting it and has the entire survey been released.
So these are all bogus then? I mean, the polls, if the polls are just telling us something that the sponsor wants us to know, why should we listen to any polls? Are they all sponsored by somebody?
No, well, let's not fold everybody into this. If you've got an academic, a university, the media, I mean, these people generally don't have stakes and the norms, and also the fact that you've got a lot of people polling at the same time. So if Rob Daves comes out with a poll that is very different from what the Pioneer Press or Minnesota Public Radio or National Public Radio finds, he's going to be red-faced, and there's going to be an outcry about, hey, how come you're so far off? So there's the kind of the free hand of competition. There's the sense of responsibility. The question you raised was about political parties, and that's the key issue, which is if you're going to consume or put much faith in their polls, you want to see the entire survey, and you really want to be suspicious of why are they giving you this privileged information they've spent a lot of money to collect.
And it's not just political parties. We want to ask this question of every organization that does a poll. Media organizations, why are you taking the poll? Well, we want people to know who's ahead and who's not, or what people think on a particular issue. If some other special interest, and I can't think of a name right now, but if some special interest does a poll, they've got a reason for doing that. We have to ask, what's the reason behind that? Is it to influence the public? Is it to influence the legislature or the U.S. Congress? We have to ask that question.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255 is our phone number, not our poll number this hour. And in fact, a little bit later, we're going to conduct a poll right here in our audience and take it apart and see what taking us a poll is like and talk to a pollster about it. How can we make polls better? I mean, what would you see? I always ask this at the end of the program. I'm going to get to the beginning of the program because it would be a long program. If you had the blank check and you could make polls better, Larry, what would you do?
Well, I think one of the most important things is transparency. We've got to have everything out front. So about 5 or 10 years ago, I was going through records of the Nixon administration when they were in the White House and found evidence that Lou Harris and, to a lesser extent, the Gallup organization were sharing information with the White House. In fact, Lou Harris changed results based on pressure from Chuck Colson and others. Well, this only happened because there was a back channel.
In the Nixon
Nixon administration. Now, there are professional organizations that are now fairly well established that have grievance committees that keep track of this. And the norm and expectation, there's a kind of a series of professional responsibilities, is that that everything has to be transparent. There can't be this kind of back channel to political organizations or interest groups or what have you. So that, I think, is one of the most important factors, that what the public is seeing is exactly what is going on. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think the full survey needs to be available. Now we've got the Internet that is a terrific tool to use, and I think a lot of polling organizations, mm-hmm. including the Star Tribune, are doing that.
There are other things. You're basically talking about making polls better. That assumes that many of them are not very good. But there are a couple of other things that we have to keep in mind, and that is the perception that polls are bad. A lot of that perception comes from things that are outside the polling world. For example, the perception that we get polled too much, we get called too much. Well, often that's not true at all. What happens is that people are confusing telemarketers with people who are doing public opinion research. They're confusing salespeople with people who are doing public opinion research.
Are there questions on a poll that are just trick questions?
Well, I think there's no doubt that there are a small number of people who are misusing survey research. And so in the last presidential election during the Republican primary, some of the candidates were going out and they appeared to be asking questions. It would be, do you support candidate X? And if the respondent answered yes, they would say, did you know that he supports X? And it was some horrible policy that he allegedly supported. Now, it turned out not to be true. This is called a push poll. And it's not designed to actually elicit in a scientific way the opinions of Americans or Republican primary voters, but rather to push the voters in a particular direction. And that is a serious misuse of polling.
So they could come away with a result that from that poll that it's skewed. It's just already...
Yeah, and it's not even aimed at really getting a poll result.
Right.
It's really aimed at changing public opinion rather than measuring it.
Mm-hmm. Does that still go on?
Yes, it sure does. And it's one thing that the professional survey research organizations keep a close eye on. And there have been some actions against organizations who are doing push polling.
So we should watch for that.
We should, I think, you know, to be a smart consumer of public opinion research, in addition to knowing who's asking the question and making sure that you read the question wording itself and look at the sample, you want to know that this is being done in a reputable way. It's not to manipulate the political process.
Hmm. So there are devious people out there taking polls, and we have to be... Robbie, you agree with that?
Yes.
Absolutely. It's a rare election that comes up that we don't see 20, 30 cases of alleged push polling.
Hmm. All right. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with Rob Davis, Lawrence Jacobs, and we're going to do our own little poll here in the right here in our auditorium. And we've already started the polling process. We're going to show you what a poll could be like and then analyze the questions in it and ask you whether you think the questions are good questions. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Alan Yelsey of Interactive Meetings in Minneapolis. We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the science of polling and how politicians use polls. We're here at the Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul. My guests are Alan Yelsey, president of Interactive Meetings in Minneapolis, Rob Daves, director of strategic and news research and director of the Minneapolis poll at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, and Lawrence Jacobs, author of Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation, and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. And we're going to begin a poll in here, but before we do, Rob, tell us how the poll we're going to conduct in our small little population here is different than when you might do in a bigger poll.
Well, first of all, it's a census. It's a census of all 59 people who are here today. And we do a sample. What that enables us to do is project from our sample to the population of all 3.5 million adults or whatever the number of likely voters are in the state. So that's one way it's different. The other way it's different is the question, the way we are doing the questioning. We would have a lot of different question types so that we'd be able to get a better read of public opinion. Today we've got just one question type.
All right. Alan, take it away. Tell us how you set this polling up.
Sure. Thanks, Ira. What we have is everyone in the audience has a small wireless device. And the device is the voting device everyone will be using. It has numbers 1 through 10 on it, buttons 1 through 10 that they'll be able to press. And we also have a window on that device that tells people what number they did press in case they want to make a change. So what we're going to do today is run a question with this audience, and the question is going to appear on a large screen in front of the room, and the audience is going to be asked to respond to it. And the question we're going to ask these folks is a technical question that Rob has some prior data on, and it is, what is the single most important problem facing the country today? And audience, what we're going to do is ask you to respond to this question by pressing 1 for the budget deficit, 2 for the economy in general, 3 for education, 4 for health care, 5 homeland security terrorism, 6 moral values, 7 war, 8 unemployment, 9 we've left blank to see if there's anyone who doesn't see their important issue on the screen, and number 10 is any other problem that's not listed here. So what we'd like to do is first see if anyone in the audience has an item they'd like to add to that list, and we can immediately do that and do a dynamic poll. Is there anyone who'd like to add an item?
Is there something missing up there that you think should be? Come up to the microphone and tell us what you think it is.
Well, I think environmental issues are an important thing.
We'll
make number 9, environmental
issues.
Someone
over here had a hand up. Yeah, did you? Yeah, come over to the mic. Environmental. I thought that was something that might be.
Yeah. The administration, the Bush administration.
Just the whole administration. Okay. That could be some other problem. You know, number 10.
We'll make that number 10,
Make
folks.
That number 10?
Exactly.
One more. I'll give you, then we'll do the voting.
Population issues.
We have no room, but that'll be the next poll. I'll say if you think population and the environment should be in the same one, vote in the environment one.
Exactly.
So we'll put them together, okay?
So now we're asking the audience to vote. Press your number now, please, and identify which of those do you think is the most important problem facing the country today. And the way this works, Ira, is this is a radio frequency device that sends a signal to an antenna. It goes into computer software that instantly processes the results. So it's designed to do all the processing of the data instantly, and it's able to show the results instantly as well. So let's take a look and see what the audience had to say.
Still counting. We're done. Okay.
There's the result. And the highest vote getter is number 10, which was
the environment.
The environment, and exactly. And no, exactly not. Bush administration.
The Bush administration.
Exactly.
All right, so go through the responses for us.
Sure.
One through what they were and what we got on them.
Sure. The highest vote getter, with 38% of our audience, said the Bush administration, followed by environmental issues, which got 13% of the vote. Another that got a high level of vote was the war issues, 11%. And also 11% were budget deficit, economy in general, then followed by some smaller results, education numbers, 6%, health care, 4%, homeland security, terrorism, 4%. So everything got a little bit of vote, just about.
Zero was unemployment, which
exactly.
I thought was interesting. No one thought in our small population. Now, how much can we extrapolate from this to a larger, Lawrence or Rob?
Yeah, this is a perfect, almost perfect, because 6 people didn't vote, almost perfect mirror of what this studio audience thinks. It is no mirror at all, mm-hmm. not even close to what you might find if you did a census of the general population or a sample of the general population.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, well, it's interesting that the environment was put in there, because I spoke to you earlier, Larry, saying what I thought was missing, that was the one I thought was missing. And over the years, I've watched polls, and none of them ever have the environment as a choice, although I know it's a very popular. But doesn't that skew then the next poll, because it wasn't stuck on the first one, got no response, so it's not going to be stuck on the next poll if you don't include that choice to begin with?
Okay, we'll tell you the secret here real quick. This question and some of the expectations of results came from a question that we've been asking since the 1940s here on the Minnesota poll here in Minnesota. And what we got last time, 31%, actually 36% said either the budget deficit or the economy in general, and very, very few people, top of mind, because this was an open-end question, we didn't ask people or categorize their responses, very few people said the environment.
Mm-hmm. Yet when you ask people, as journalists ask people all the time, what's on the top of your mind, and the environment's usually one or two someplace.
And that's exactly right, and that's a good example of what Larry was saying earlier. If you ask an open-end question, the most important problem facing the nation today, people will give you what's on the top of their mind. However, if you ask them it another way, how important or how serious a problem is the environment in the United States, you'll get a huge response saying, very serious. Mm-hmm. So the way you ask the question is incredibly important.
Alan, can you break this out at all for us?
We sure can. We asked earlier a question of the audience, and that was a gender question, whether they were male or female. And we're looking now at the results to see if there's a difference between men and women and how they responded to this question. And indeed, there are some differences. The war issue, women have war as significantly more of a top issue, 20% versus men. Let's take a look.
Well, the number 10, the Bush administration was about equal, 27 and 31%.
That's right, exactly.
And the number 9, the environment was significantly higher among males than females.
Than women.
That is interesting. Men were more concerned with the environment by a large. I'd say that's at least 3-1 there, 2-3-1.
Exactly. Economy in general.
And then
more men than women.
Interesting.
By double.
Interesting. Do these tell you anything about how to make the questions different? I mean, or last-minute questions that you might not think of?
Well, one of the things that we have, and a way to look at this is that we do see something, a pattern here that's fairly common in public opinion research, and that is that typically men will select issues or think that issues dealing with pocketbook are more serious. And women often think that issues closer to the heart, social issues and things like that, are more serious. And you see that mm-hmm. same breakout here, and that's the same breakout, or those are similar breakouts at what we would see mm-hmm. in a Minnesota poll.
What's interesting, and I will move on because I don't want to beat this dead horse, is that the two biggest vote getters were ones that were not in the poll, that we put in ourselves from the audience.
It all depends on how you ask the question.
Okay. Remember that. Now, let me ask you this, Larry. Now, let's say this is a bigger poll. A politician sees the results of this poll. Does he say, uh-oh, I better change my message that I'm giving to the voters if I want the support of these people? Is that how he or she uses the poll?
They may not change the content of the message, but for sure looking at this poll would tell you a lot about what topics to talk about. And so, for instance, it's very interesting here that among women, the war was one of their major concerns, mm-hmm. where it wasn't among men. So if you're a candidate who believes that women are going to be the base of your support, where you're looking to improve your support, you're going to talk about the war. This poll doesn't tell you what angle to take on the war, mm-hmm. or you know what the content of your comments might be, but it tells you what topics. And so what we see nationally is that jobs and the economy are, by quite a margin, the biggest issue of concern. And what we see then is President Bush going around the country talking about jobs and the economy, and we see the Democratic candidates doing the same. So it's telling them what topics are on the minds and really of intense concern mm-hmm. to Americans.
I'm sorry, Larry, do you want to...
Just one quick comment, Ira. The value of these devices is that we can now do follow-up instantly with an audience. And so we may not do that here today, but...
Have you got a suggestion you'd like to follow up with?
Be able to probe...
You could think of something and come back to it later.
Sure. Why don't we do that? We'll do a follow-up. But the value is that you can do a dynamic follow-up with an audience and be able to probe, see exactly what is behind what people have to say, instead of being stuck with some results and trying to figure it out later.
Now, Larry, we always hear that politicians are polling. They look at the results, and then they form their policy based on the polls. But your writings don't seem to indicate that.
Well, there's clearly some policies where politicians, government officials, the president, members of Congress respond, and respond by way of changing or adopting a proposal or a policy. And, you know, for instance, there's concern about drug benefits for seniors. And so we see both parties working on passing a Medicare drug benefit program. But we've seen over the last couple of decades, there's a number of political scientists and others who have been looking at this in fairly rigorous ways, who have seen a kind of drop-off, particularly in the last couple of decades, looking at the polls and policy. So, for instance, here's a couple examples on the area of health care. There's very large majority support for a patient's bill of rights, but it's not emerged out of Congress or Washington yet. There's very strong support for health insurance for all Americans, even if it means repealing the tax cuts or raising taxes or infringing or encroaching on the bedrock employer-based system, and yet we haven't seen movement on that. And so the list of issues where Americans favor something and politicians aren't moving on them.
They're not moving on, but are they then, what are they doing then with the poll results if they see there is great interest in this? Are they then just changing their message to sort of hide behind a different message that's not really a different message?
Well, exactly. So they might see that, and certainly the president and Democrats are looking at the numbers on health care, which is usually the number two or three issue on these most important problem questions, and they've all got proposals on health care.
So they know there's a health care interest, so they're going to say, okay, I'm attacking the health care interest, but I'm not really changing my position. I'm just being vocal so you hear that I'm being vocal about health care, but not really changing any of my position.
Exactly. And that's been the key change in the last couple of decades. There was a period, ironically, during the Nixon administration, where there was a very high level of responsiveness. Mm-hmm. We saw a whole number of policies coming through on foreign policy and domestic policy that were very responsive to what many Americans preferred. We've seen a real fall off in the last couple of decades.
So they use the poll to get on the record about something. They can say, I'm active on this issue that you're concerned about, but I haven't changed my position about helping you on that issue.
Exactly. And there's the issue about kind of following the agenda of the public, and I think there's very high responsiveness there. There's been a drop-off in terms of the content of the policy. But where we're seeing a lot of use of polling by politicians, because after all, millions of dollars are being spent by the Democrats and Republicans on polling, is the use of polling to figure out the words and the symbols and the arguments to make.
For example?
Well, I think the example you started off with on Iraq is a good one. You know, I think I'm not inside the White House, but I would suspect that Karl Rove and others are doing a lot of polling, and they're seeing that there's majority support. It's certainly come down over the last 6 months, but there's still majority support for the war, for removing Saddam Hussein as the right thing to do. And the president goes around the country. These are the words he's using. Now, the Democrats have done their own polling, and they see that Americans are very dissatisfied with the rising casualties and the financial costs, and that's what they're emphasizing. And you'll even hear the Democrats say, we agree with the war, we disagree with how it's being done.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, talking about polling this hour. And excuse me, Rob, did you want to jump in on that?
Well, Larry's examples extend to campaign polling, too, because I had a campaign pollster tell me one time, your job is to be accurate. I didn't disagree with her there. She said, if my numbers and your numbers are different, my job is to make sure my candidate proves your numbers wrong if he's behind. That's my job as a campaign pollster.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. The microphones are here waiting if you'd like to ask a question from the audience. Let's go to the phones then. Let's go to Reno. Dan in Reno. Hi, Dan. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi.
How are you?
Hi. Go ahead, please.
Well, it seems to me that Americans are incredibly fickle people. I mean, could you imagine in the Civil War if Abe Lincoln would have had to respond to polls, if in fact there was polling at that time? And where our country would be today, we'd probably be two or three different countries.
Any response?
Well,
Rob?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Fickle, maybe that's a good word. I would think that let's use another word that's really a favored word right now. On many issues, Americans have come to public judgment. That's a word that Dan, or a phrase that Dan Yankelovich uses, because they've gotten the information, they've seen all of the different sides of the argument, they've heard it over and over, and they've come to public judgment about the topic. There are lots of other issues that are very divisive that are still emerging where people have not come to public mm-hmm. judgment, and that's why you see so many different ups and downs in the polls.
Lawrence Jacobs?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Benjamin Page and Robert Shapiro went back and looked at almost 60 years of public opinion polling. And looking at literally thousands of polling questions, they found very little instances of significant change, that is, you know, 10 points or more. Let's go back to the Clinton impeachment episode. It was remarkable. At the beginning of the year when the episode launched onto the front pages of our papers, Americans were opposed. And almost the same proportion were opposed a year later when the impeachment episode came to an end. So in this example is really very typical of what we tend to see, which is fairly stable public opinion, except if there's new information or conditions change and people respond to that.
And then that's another case you point out of where the politicians did not listen to the public opinion, right? Americans really, even though they were upset with what the president was doing, they didn't want to impeach him.
Exactly. And, you know, what we saw is Republicans coming forward and saying, we're not responding to the polls. We know that Americans disagree with us, but we think that it's important for our constitutional system to do this. So, you know, a lot of times we do have these kind of very public discussions about not mm-hmm. responding.
Rob Daves?
Another good example of that is desegregation. Tom Smith at NORC in Chicago did a study one time, it's been several years ago, about how attitudes on major things change. And he concluded that basically two things, one of two things could happen to make major changes on attitudes where people have come to public judgment on something like desegregation. One is something he called cohort replacement. That means older folks die, younger folks take their place, and attitudes change that way. And the other is some sort of catastrophic event like a war or something.
Yeah, some sort of a paradigm shift. We're going to take a short break, come back, and maybe poll the audience again. This was fun. Okay. And then analyze it, come up to the microphone if you have questions. We'll take more of your questions on the telephone. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the science of polling and how politicians use polls with my guests, Lawrence Jacobs, co-author of Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness, Rob Daves, Director of Strategic and News Research and Director of the Minnesota Poll at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, Alan Yelsey, president of Interactive Meetings in Minneapolis, and we're broadcasting from Minnesota, from the Science Museum of Minnesota in St. Paul. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the audience and get a question here. Sir.
Yes, I'd like to explore the term likely voters. How does that impact polls? How do you determine who they are? And then a little reverse on that, do you find people that once they've been polled say, well, I don't need a vote, I got my voice out there?
Rob?
Well, good questions. Likely voters is a tough thing to do. That's one of the toughest things in pre-election polls, is to discern who is actually going to vote. And in fact, we're trying to get away from the term of likely voters. In Minnesota, it doesn't work out at all because everyone is a likely voter. You can go to the polls on election day and register to vote. So everyone's a likely voter. Some people are more likely than other people to show up. So what we have to do is model a likely electorate. And the way we do that is by asking a series of questions.
And how do you know who the undecided voters are?
Well, that's a little bit different. I mean, everybody can be undecided whether you're likely to vote or not. Unlikely voters tend to be a little bit more undecided than likely voters are. But we basically ask the question, if the election were held today, would you vote for Democrat candidate A or Republican candidate B or Independent Party candidate C or so on, and list all of the candidates on the ballot. And then anybody who doesn't pick one, they're undecided.
Do you go back to these people? You keep track of who they are, the undecideds, to get an idea of polling just the undecided? See how they voted?
Not in the types of polls that we do. We always measure that to understand how large the pool of undecideds are and look at them demographically to see whether they're more women or men or whatever. But we don't go back except when we do our reporting. Our reporters might call people who agreed get a return call and further explore anecdotally why they might be undecided, who they're leaning toward, what makes them undecided, and those kinds of things.
We before the break, we were talking about how difficult it is to change anybody's opinion about anything, Larry. And does a poll change anybody's opinion about their own way, which way they should swing their vote or anything? Or is it still very difficult, Lawrence Jacobs?
Yeah, so it generally has very little impact in terms of policy preferences, particularly long-term values. Do you support the role of government or not? When you look at an election, it can have an impact, particularly in a primary. Democrats who are looking out wondering, gee, who should I vote among this kind of list of nine potential candidates, might be influenced by the fact that some of them are doing fairly poorly in terms of fundraising and in terms of electability chances. Others are doing better. So they might start looking at, the top three. That probably is the most important kind of impact in these early election sorting out mechanisms.
Later in the election, of course, people who are polled by whomever typically attend to the process a little bit more frequently, more directly later on, and might be a little bit more likely to turn out. But the percentage of the population at any given time who might receive a phone call from a pollster is very, very small. In Minnesota, you're probably asking, why haven't I been called? Well, the chances are about 1 in every 3,500 or 1 in 3,500 that on any given poll you might get a call.
Mm-hmm. Alan, one of the advantages you say of your polling system is we can instantly change and upgrade and react.
Exactly.
Right? Can we do that now? Have you got a question we want to ask?
Let's do it.
People in our audience have a polling box or a little sampling box. And
what we saw earlier is that there was a demographic difference in the audience's perception of the war, and women by far in this audience looked at the war is a more significant issue than men. So we're going to follow up and see if we can understand that. We're going to ask for three inputs from the audience about what concerns you most about the war as a follow-up. Then we'll ask the entire audience to vote and see if there's a ranking of those items and see what we learn.
Okay.
So from the audience,
someone who voted that the war was number one on their list, what concerns you most? Anybody out there want to express an opinion about what concerns you most about the war? And step up to the microphone. Anybody there? See, democracy in action.
Here we go.
Oh. I'm concerned about the mounting casualties.
Mounting casualties, okay. We'll put that up there. Yes, ma'am?
I'm concerned about the attitude of imperialism and nation building. That's kind of our overall attitude and when we went in.
Our attitude, okay.
World opinion of the United States.
Okay, number three. Good enough for three?
We've got three items.
All right, now... vote, I guess. Those three. While you're voting, let me ask you, all three of you, do you ever find people lying now? Do people lie to pollsters? And how do you control it? They're lying, to see if they're lying or not? I mean, you know, people hate so many polls going on, they may say, I'm going to wreck this poll because I hate being asked so many questions from, you know, people on the phone bothering me at dinner time, stuff like that.
Well, you hit on a couple of issues that are out there and that are concerns from public opinion researchers. One is refusals. We do have, not every poll has 100% response rate, not even this one here. On the first question, we had six folks who didn't vote for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So we have to be understand the effect of that.
So hanging kind of chad on those.
Hanging
votes.
Chad, yeah, on the non-response there. Right. But in terms of lying, despite what some of columnists, more mean-spirited columnists out there might ask you to do. You know, it's remarkable. We have very few people who really, in a mean-spirited sort of undercutting kind of way, go out and lie. Do people perhaps misremember about what they did or what they might do? Yeah, that happens all the time, even in real life right here.
Lawrence, before we get the answer,
Race is one of the issues where we do see, it's not lying, but it's a sense of what's sociably acceptable. So when you ask Americans about their attitudes towards busing or a black candidate, mm-hmm. particularly white respondents, we tend to see a difference going across. So we've invented a variety of different kinds of mechanisms to try to get past that. But I wouldn't describe that as lying.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's go. Let's look at our results. Put them up there. Ooh.
We have.
Do you want to analyze that for us, Alan?
Certainly. 54% of the audience said that the imperialist attitude was the biggest concern, followed by, with 30% of the vote, for world opinion of the U.S., and then lastly, 16% of mounting casualties. So what we have is we've identified three items. We've forced the audience to choose among those three, and these are the priorities that they've selected.
And one of the things that we learn in public opinion research school is that the two things that have to be there in any response set for a question, for it to be a good question, in other words, a complete question. One is that all the categories have to be there. It's a complete set of responses, and they have to be mutually exclusive. What we've done here is take some convenient things to measure, but they don't meet either of those criteria. So what we're doing here is just taking the audience pulse on these three things today.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, Larry?
Yeah, I would jump in and agree with what Rob just said there. I mean, this obviously doesn't reflect in any way a kind of a larger population, and there are majorities of Americans who favor the war, and some of the concerns that aren't included there would include the potential damage to American credibility if we were to pull out.
Let me go to the gentleman standing here for a question.
Yeah, when someone who sounds like a telemarketer calls, I hang up. Well, my wife, who is polite, she doesn't, and she talks to them. So how does that kind of, this kind of self-exclusion dependent on gender, socioeconomic position, cultural background, race, or whatever?
Right.
And by virtue of that, bias is the outcome.
Yeah. We know we're learning a great deal about non-response. We know, for example, basically because the people at the University of Maryland, the Pew Center, and the University of Michigan have done some really, really wonderful research about it, is that people who are hard to get a hold of, not exactly like the kind of folks you were talking about, but people who are hard to get a hold of, their attitudes and beliefs on many, many things are not too much different from everybody else's. What we don't know are a lot about the refusers, and those are topics that we're looking into, too.
We're talking about polling this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News here at the Science Museum of Minnesota. Did you want to jump in?
Yes, just a moment of comment. What we're seeing now is that the technology we're using here in the room is becoming widely available throughout the world, and what that does is it takes the poll and that doesn't take it out of the hands of our professional pollsters, but allows people in all sorts of environments to be able to take the pulse of their audience instantly with follow-up. And so it's a marvelous new tool that can be taken advantage of in corporate settings, in educational settings. Schools all over the country are using these tools. And it becomes a very nice enabling technology for democracy.
We see these polls all the time on cable shows now, people voting by the Internet. Lawrence, what do you think of these polls? They put any stock in them at all since they're coming from the Internet?
There's some Internet polls that are, I think, are fairly thoughtful, and there may be, in fact, a breakthrough on some of the Internet polling. But clearly...
not on the talk shows when they say vote whether Rosie O'Donnell should go to
exactly.
prison or something.
And you know, it's kind of, if you're dealing with a kind of scientific enterprise like survey research rather than the kind of talk show sort of thing, mm-hmm. you worry about the credibility of your enterprise because it has at least some vague resemblance to what else is going on. These are totally different enterprises.
I would agree. You know, the word poll can take on a whole plethora of meanings. For example, you can do a scientific poll. Okay, that's good. We've got that out of the way. We know about that. Larry was talking about a push poll earlier. First of all, it's not science. It's a campaign technique, an underhanded campaign technique at that. And then the other things that we were just talking about are these audience participation things. They're not as much polls as they are audience participation, reader response if you're in a newspaper, or Internet response. So let's be clear about that.
One quick question, time from the audience.
Yeah, I was wondering, early in the year, I was called about a poll about Iraq and, you know, what we were potentially going to do. Mm-hmm. And the questions that were asked sort of forced me you know, pigeonholed me into either sort of a do you support it or do you not support it, rather than having some sort of middle ground. You guys had commented a little bit about how the questions are formed and, you know, the various responses that you ask. I mean, is there a thought that you really should provide more of a middle ground for people that, you know, have maybe thought more about it than simply yes or no?
Or let me ask Carly, if he doesn't like the question, doesn't think it's fair, should he just not answer it and tell you? Do you keep track of, I think this is not a good question, it's not a fair one?
Yeah, we do, and the issue you raise is really a fundamental topic of debate. And what you've described is a fixed response categories. It's A or B, it's binary. Sometimes you have three choices. But what's really being missed there is the complexity, and people will say, yeah, but. And so we're developing different kinds of techniques for eliciting that complexity of view. So it's a problem. On the other hand, it does give us, you know, what I would say is a crude measure for the balance of opinion. It's not very sophisticated, but it's crude.
Okay, and here's the little secret now. You can, I'll tell you this. If it's a pretty good poll, most pollsters will have built in a way for you to say some other response and then record that. And so they'll know the people who say, oh, I'm not going to tell you A or I'm not going to tell you B. I'll go to the middle ground.
All right, we've just about run out of time. This is a fascinating topic. I'd like to thank my guest this hour, Rob Daves, Director of Strategic and News Research and Director of the Minnesota Poll at the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, Lawrence Jacobs, co-author of Politicians Don't Pander, Political Manipulation and the Loss of Democratic Responsiveness. That's out from the University of Chicago Press. It was out, published in 2000. He's also the Land-Grant McKnight Professor at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis and director of the 2004 Election Project at the Hubert H. Humphrey Institute there. Also, Alan Yelsey, president of Interactive Meetings in Minneapolis, who supplied us with these little polling devices and kits here today. Thank you for bringing that along. It was a fascinating exercise in taking the pulse of our audience. Thank you all, though, for joining me this hour.
My pleasure.
Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director and our web producer, and we had up today from Evie Stone in Washington, from Mike Vinup and Dan Pearson from Interactive Meetings. Also, thanks to the Science Museum of Minnesota and Minnesota Public Radio for hosting our broadcast, and to the Medtronic Foundation for sponsoring our visit to the Twin Cities. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. Also, you can surf over to our website. If you missed what we talked about today, we have links up on the website for the whole week. And you can also listen to prior versions of Science Friday on Real Audio. You can also download them, subscribe on your audio audible.com player. Take them along with you and listen to them when you want to. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. We make free curricula for science teachers and their students out of this. And you can use our materials to teach Science Friday material in your classroom. I'm Ira Flato in St. Paul.